Yeah, you know, I lied about it for a long time, covered it up. You know, doping was at the highest level of cycling, at the Tour de France level. It was very prevalent. And, you know, I got caught and lied about it for a long time. Yeah, I was like, I was living in my own personal prison with all my lies. And, you know, I thought I was doing it for noble causes. You know, I wanted to protect all my old teammates. I wanted to protect myself. I wanted to protect the sport of cycling. But little did I know, is, you know, that was the worst thing I could have done.
Hello and welcome to A New Angle. I'm your host, Justin Angle, Associate Professor of Marketing here at the University of Montana College of Business. This podcast is my chance to talk with innovative thinkers, both savvy vets and up-and-coming stars in the Montana business ecosystem. My goal with these conversations is to dig deep into how these people think, to understand how they view the world and conceptualize the opportunities it presents. Let's go. Hello and welcome to A New Angle. Thanks for tuning in. If you enjoyed our promo or our interview with Bryce Ward and are coming back for more, thank you. Thank you for your dedication. We appreciate the support. We're trying to grow this thing. And if you're new to the show, we are excited to have you. So please spread the word. Help us grow this audience. Today was a really interesting conversation to me, sort of special and emotional and complicated at the same time. I got the chance to catch up with Tyler Hamilton. Many of you might recognize that name. Tyler is a retired professional cyclist, a professional cyclist at the highest level, Olympic gold medalist. He rode on three Tours de France with Lance Armstrong during his reign of terror over there and has won numerous other races and competed at the highest level. But that all came crashing down starting in late 2004 when he was popped for doping. Positive test for blood doping. And he had a long fight with that. But eventually, he was one of the first guys to come out and tell the truth. And in many ways, his truth is to me, the most transparent of all those stories. He wrote an excellent book in 2011 called The Secret Race. I encourage you to check it out. He's told his story on 60 Minutes. There was a great profile of him by Graham Benzinger that's available on YouTube. I encourage you to look at that. And his story about that whole part of his life and the realities of professional cycling, that's been well told elsewhere. So in this conversation, we tried to take a different approach. I tried to think about what else from Tyler might be interesting. And we tried to get in, how do you go about making change in your life? Because that's essentially what he's trying to do. How do you go about making change in your life? And he is in the process of doing that. And the second part of that question is, why is Missoula a particularly good place for somebody to do that? It was a fun conversation. I enjoyed getting to know Tyler more. We have a far-ranging conversation. Doesn't quite fit into the business framework we have here at the College of Business, but an interesting guy with an interesting story and a really good perspective on how to make change in your life. So without any further ado, I give you Tyler Hamilton. Okay, so I'm here today with Tyler Hamilton. Tyler, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me. It's an honor to be here.
So you are, I mean, gosh, it's funny. You kind of operate in this space where there's a large percentage of the population who doesn't know much about you or who you are. And then there's this white hot segment of the population that feels like they know a whole lot.
Sure.
Yeah. So maybe just tell us a little bit about who you are and the path you took to get to Missoula. I know that's a huge question.
Yeah.
We'll get into some of the details here.
Yeah, right. Who am I? Yeah, I grew up, I'm an East Coaster. I grew up in just north of Boston.
Marblehead?
A town called Marblehead, yeah. So I got Boston my blood, which means I'm a Red Sox fan, a Patriots fan, Bruins, and Celtics.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, so I love sports. Grew up, really enjoying sports. That was my favorite sport growing up, downhill ski racing. Mm-hmm. Really thrived.
And so we talked about it. I grew up in New Hampshire, so a lot of the Guilford. Similar kind of stomping grounds from our youth. You know, I remember actually my first kind of touch point with you was at the Mount Washington Hill climb.
It was you were there?
96 or 97.
Nice.
Yeah, and this, you know, this this legendary pro, collegiate national champ just comes in and rides away from the whole field. It's pretty, and that's a brutal event.
That's one of the hardest hill climbs, I think, in the world.
Is it like 22% at the top?
At the top, it's like 22%. I think it's like 7.5 miles at an average grade of like 12.5%, which you don't see anything close to that in the Tour de France.
No.
Not even close.
I think the running times are almost as fast, if not faster, than many of the biking times. That's
correct, yes, yes, yep.
And which I certainly felt like I could probably be running faster than I was riding my bike.
Did you run it?
I've ridden up it, yeah. Yeah.
Ridden or
run? I haven't done the running race. I've done the bike race.
Good for you.
Yeah, a lot of suffering. So anyway, we kind of bounced into the intro there, but you know, so Tyler, former professional cyclist, the highest level of the sport, one of the most decorated American, but also cyclist worldwide. And then the thing that I think propelled you to many people's radar screen was the doping stuff and how you told your story. You've written a wonderful book called The Secret Race. 2011, that book came out, 2012?
I think it was 2012, I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah, right when I moved here.
And so you've told that story so honestly and with such sort of just raw transparency on a lot of other platforms. I encourage listeners to check that out. I just saw you did a really nice series with Grant Benzinger, in-depth interview series, and your 60 Minutes appearance and many interviews. So listeners can get that information elsewhere. But kind of what I'm interested in this conversation, if you're willing, is to talk about making change in your life, finding opportunity when you need to, when you need to hustle, the doors close, and then also a little bit about why this community of Missoula is a place where you've been able to do that. We moved here at about the same time, 2012, and I moved here for a job. You moved here. Well, why did you move here?
I moved here just for a change of pace. I was living in Boulder, Colorado, which is a great town. You know, I went to college there and kind of called that my sort of home base. I raced over in Europe professionally. You'd be over there for 9-10 months out of the year, but then it was always nice to come back to Boulder. Great place, but it was there were a lot of things going on at that time in 2012, and it was time to make a change. I had heard Bozeman was like a small Boulder, so that got me interested in Montana originally, and then I was started to do a little bit of investigating online, and I saw Missoula, and I really just fell in love with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I don't want a small Boulder. I want something totally new. Nothing against Bozeman. Bozeman's a great town.
Yeah.
Beautiful. But Missoula is a special place.
So then had you been here before? Were you just like, hey, let's go check it out? Or
I came here for like a long weekend. I drove up from Boulder. I think I was here 3 days, and I knew it.
It grabbed you pretty quickly.
It grabbed me quickly. And I was like, this is a great place. And obviously it's super beautiful around here. You know, you can get out in the middle of nowhere very quickly.
Yeah.
But it's the people. The people are great. The people are what make Missoula so special.
Yeah, so what is it about those people? I feel the same way. I mean, I kind of have some ideas. It's a sense. But what have you found about the people here that have been
just down to earth and pretty relaxed? And, you know, most people leave their ego at the doorway. And I like that. Coming from Boulder, you know, Boulder, there's a gazillion athletes, you know, high caliber athletes.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a lot of, you know, there were a lot of big egos there. And that was kind of hard to get away from. I feel like I'm a normal person here. And people treat me like a normal person here, which is, I love.
And that's working for you now.
It's great.
Yeah.
I am a normal person.
I mean, I would think in Boulder at that time of your life, it's almost like living a Strava segment, if you will. So for listeners that don't know, Strava is like this social media exercise logging platform where like you upload your workouts and everybody's examining you and comparing them themselves. I mean, the culture in Boulder almost feels like you're walking around in a
Strava. A lot of people looking at you.
So here you can kind of move here.
I've been here 5.5 years. I feel kind of like I've been on some sort of little getaway.
Yeah.
Some sort of retreat.
But at the same time.
That's been fantastic. Although I've had to deal with a bunch of stuff. You know, I finished writing that book here. It took me about 2.5 years to write. And I think the last 6 months were here in Missoula.
Yeah.
And then I came out when I was here. And then that book. It was a big deal for a while, I guess.
It's, I think it's huge fair to deal. Say.
And so that it was a couple years of just kind of dealing with all that, you know, the fallout from all that. I guess the good, the bad, and the ugly from that book.
Yeah. So what? So you, I assume you did a book tour of some kind and did some.
Not necessarily a book tour, but yeah, I guess I travel a lot.
Right. Promote the book. Yeah. Tell the story. I mean, I've seen you talk a couple times at the Wilma. I saw you talk at the, it was like the Chamber of Commerce dinner last year.
Yeah.
And I mean, the way with which you've told your story is you've just gone so much deeper than anybody else in a style that's totally believable, totally transparent and admirable to me, particularly as somebody who's a huge fan of yours and the sport. And it's just such a breath of fresh air in a way.
Yeah, you know, I lied about it for a long time, covered it up. You know, doping was at the highest level of cycling, at the Tour de France level. It was very prevalent. And, you know, I got caught and lied about it for a long time. Yeah, it was like I was living in my own personal prison with all my lies. And, you know, I thought I was doing it for noble causes. You know, I wanted to protect all my old teammates. I wanted to protect myself. I wanted to protect the sport of cycling. But little did I know, you know, that was the worst thing I could have done. So when I did feel like I had the opportunity to tell the truth, it was like a huge weight off my back. Mm-hmm. And I saw how it could help other people. And yeah, I've just kind of gone with it. It feels like the right thing to do. You know, I wish I'd done it way sooner. You know, I wish I'd never gotten involved. But it was a pretty rotten sport at that time, at the highest level, in terms of doping.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. And it's something I'd love to get your thoughts on is professional sports in general. How do we, as an academic, I'm sort of trained to be a skeptic. So how do you reconcile your sort of experience with how you view sport in general? And because you coach kids up at Snowball. I see you up there all the time coaching these junior racers.
Yeah.
It's a sport is such a force for good in our lives, but how do we partition that from our feelings towards what's going on at the highest levels?
Yeah. Up to a certain level, you know, I love it. And then afterwards, I think I'm a little bit maybe skeptical or not 100% sure, really, you know, based on what I've seen. I speak a lot about all this and I get a lot of people afterwards from the crowd that come up and tell me, share a story about themselves personally or a brother or sister, or whatever, or a friend who went through something. So I've heard a lot of stories about a lot of different sports. It's not just cycling was not the only sport that had a problem. Yeah. It's everywhere at the highest level where people are making money, where there's big sponsors. And it's, you know, after this whole cycling really explosion with the doping, with that news coming out, four or five years ago?
Pretty much,
You know, a lot of people have said, okay, now it's all gone. It's all behind us. That's far from the case. You know, we have to work harder now in all sport to try to make sure we have clean sport. We don't have clean sport today. That's a fact.
Yeah, you know? I mean, it would seem like this thing where
I've heard horrible stories about kids in high school, before high school. I'm not going to say the sports that I've heard, but junior high school.
Well, there's a lot of rewards to it.
You know, they want to get a Division I scholarship.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that means they have to be on the team their freshman year in high school, whatever. Like, stories. But I've heard stories from all different sports. From politicians, from people on Wall Street, from you name it, I've heard it. And it's been pretty eye-opening.
So my first fall teaching here, I had a student approach me about academic doping. Yeah. He didn't call it that, but he was talking about Adderall and other prescription meds.
That's a huge problem.
Yeah. And if it's performance enhancing in terms of your academic performance, then we're talking about some interesting life questions with, you know, if somebody outperforms on the SAT or in class and that opens doors into colleges that other people might not. It's a big deal.
It is a big deal.
So how do we as a society, I mean, right now, like in sport, it's easy to sort of say, well, here's the list of things you can do and can't do. And so people sort of, those are the rules and they either choose to obey them or not.
That, you know, in every sport, there's giant loopholes.
Yeah, exactly.
So if you're at the elite level, you know, plenty of people to help you. There are plenty of people will let you know where the loopholes are and how to avoid having a positive test.
I mean, is that just the nature of competition? That people are going to always find those loopholes, those lines, and try to, like, but that famous baseball quote, if you ain't cheating, you ain't trying.
Oh, yeah, who said that?
Yeah, somebody.
That's interesting. in my opinion, I mean, the pressure to succeed these days is, you know, it's never been this high. Whatever it is in academics, in the business world, in sports. So when that pressure is so high, like people are going to eventually cut a corner a little bit. And then the next time, maybe a little bit more. And then before you know it, you're deep into it, up to your neck in it.
And then a problem.
And then you take a step back. You're like, how did I get here? That's kind of what happened to me, at least. And, you know, people tell me stories about on Wall Street, you know, how they're groomed. They get in there fresh out of college and they, you know, they pick out the ones that can trust. And before they know it, they're deep into it, not happy about where they are.
Yeah.
Maybe happy about the, you know, money they're making, but not ethically where they are in their life.
And so, you've been in that space where you're locked in, and I don't exactly know what that feels like, but
it's a strange place.
Yeah, and so how do you add the weight of the sort of federal government and that investigation, sort of say, hey, you got to come in and tell the truth, or you go to jail.
Yeah.
Some people don't tell the truth even in that instance.
Oh yeah, many didn't. Many didn't. And I can tell you a few.
How do you make change in your life when you feel like the walls are closing in?
Honestly, I felt like I was lucky that all happened. It kind of reset my whole life. It totally grounded me.
Yeah.
It opened my eyes. And it was like, wow. By just telling the truth, I saved myself. I was a mess inside. I was in my own personal prison. You know, I thought I was doing it for all the right reasons. I got to keep this secret. I got to take it to the grave. So for all my old buddies that I'm really not even friends with anymore, but I got to, you know, protect them, old fraternity mates in a way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I got to protect the sport. You know, I don't want to be that guy. And then eventually it was like, you know, I got a call from Jeff Nowitzki, a federal agent. There was an investigation into Lance Armstrong and the old U.S. Postal team. And I was like, okay. Backed up to the edge of the cliff, and it was either jump off or tell the truth.
Right.
And I went into this courtroom in Los Angeles, you know, sat there for 7 hours and just unloaded the truth. You know, I went in with like a 100-pound backpack on, and I came out. It was gone.
Yeah.
Obviously, there's been some tough moments since then.
For sure.
But since then, it's been, life has changed a lot. Been heading uphill again, you know.
Yeah.
In a good way.
Let's get into some of that life change. So, you know, I'm sure that moment was sort of the end of the beginning in a way. And then all of a sudden life gets crazy with a book and 60 Minutes and media and lawsuits and all that stuff.
Sure.
It seems like some of that dust has settled to some degree.
Oh, I would say a lot. I mean, there's still stuff out there that's happening, but it's settled a lot for sure.
So now you're here in Missoula.
For sure.
It's you know, you got your feet on the ground here.
Yeah.
But I'm sure as a professional cyclist, you did quite well, but it's not like you're Barry Bonds retiring. You got to work. You got to.
No, I'm starting over financially, everything. I'm kind of starting over, you know. It took a little time to kind of come to terms with that, but it's been good. I think it's been good, really good for me.
Okay.
I'm starting over completely. And what better place than Missoula, Montana?
Sure. So, and so you have.
I feel pretty lucky there.
I mean, you've done a bit of real estate work, but that.
Yeah, I tried the real estate work. You know, I was a realtor for about a year at Inc. Realty Group, which is a great group of people. I had a blast. It wasn't really me.
Mm-hmm.
But at that time, I had gotten back from a trip where I did a bunch of talks. I was a little bit tired of it. I came back and I was like, I want to do something completely different.
Totally different.
But during that year of being a realtor, I realized that I missed kind of focusing on the things that I really like to do, which was cycling coaching business.
Yeah. Tyler Hamilton training.
Yeah. So that's been fantastic. And focusing more on that. Focusing more on, I spent a lot of time working on the fight against MS.
Yes. Okay.
So I've been doing that since 1997. So I've kind of doubled down and focusing more on that. I do a lot of work with this charity in Colorado, in Vail, Colorado.
Okay.
It's called Can Do MS.
So what was the connection point to multiple sclerosis?
Originally, growing up, there was a guy, a ski racer by the name of Jimmy Hugo.
Okay.
Who was an absolute stud. He won a bronze medal in the 64 Olympic Games in the slalom. And then by the late 60s was feeling symptoms of MS. So I knew all about him when I was growing up as a ski racer.
Sure.
And I heard about this disease that he had, which was called MS, multiple sclerosis. And then, I, you know, years moving forward, I was a professional cyclist, and a good friend of mine, his mother-in-law had MS. And he invited me to go to a charity ride in Massachusetts where I was living at the time. So it kind of started out simply like that. I went and did a 75-mile charity ride, and I met people with MS. I met, you know, people whose husband or wife had MS, and they were there riding for them, or a coworker or a friend. And I was like, wow, this is – and I felt like me being there was helpful. And, yeah, I said, I'm going to keep doing stuff like this. And it's just grown and grown and grown over the years.
Yeah, and so now you do this work with MS Global. And you do these,
I put on a ride called MS Global. I started that 15 years ago. It's been awesome. It's a week-long ride every September. Yeah. We change locations every year. Last year was in Mallorca, Spain.
Okay.
This year will be in Moab, Utah. We raised, I think, $250,000 last year, which was great.
That's amazing.
So, now I do some. I do a bunch of ski events for this CanDo program. You know, it used to be called the Jimmy Huga Foundation. Now it's called CanDo MS.
Okay.
When Jimmy was first diagnosed with MS, they said, "You're just sit on the couch and save your energy." He was an athlete, and he did that for a couple of years and realized that was no life to live. And he started being active again, and it really changed his life.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I know.
That's what they teach people in these CanDo programs. And it's fantastic. I went and sat through a four-day program, and it was just really eye-opening. And you could see people's lives changing right in front of you.
And that has to be
pretty awesome.
I mean, it has to resonate with you in the process of making big change in your own life, I would think.
Yeah. What I've realized, since coming here to Missoula is what makes me happy. I love helping people.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, like, whatever I can do to help a person, anybody, that's what I enjoy doing. It's very fulfilling.
Yeah.
Whether it's coaching kids or, coaching cyclists that,
right.
I have this business, or helping people in the MS community or whatever. I don't know. I want to do more around this community. I deliver food once a month for the food bank.
Okay.
I've done some work at the Poverello Center. We're all pretty lucky, There's a lot of people out there who've been dealt bad hands.
Yeah.
And we all need to give back more. We can all do more. I can do more.
So, the life of a professional athlete is hugely self-centered in a way.
Oh, big time. You're so focused on yourself. Yeah.
And now your life has changed. You can see this sort of service orientation, coaching other athletes to help them succeed. You're raising money and helping people fighting a disease. And this coaching up at Snowball, I see up there, it seems joyful.
It is
with
joyful.
The kids up there.
Yeah. Great kids.
And so has that been an explicit choice in your life to seek opportunities to serve? Or has it just sort of... you've arrived at that place.
Yeah, I think it's just it just kind of happened naturally. The ski race, I grew up a ski racer, so for me it's kind of come full circle now, coaching, lugging around the gates.
Yeah.
Kind of standing on the hill, watching kids ski by. Yeah, that's kind of come naturally. Yeah.
And so how about the complicated relationship with the bike industry? So get out of cycling, and then I'm sure there are times where you're like, I don't want anything to do with a bike or cycling or any of that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, that's a big part of your DNA, I would think.
It was. I took a big step away from cycling for a while. I still had a coaching business, a biking coaching business, but I did very little riding myself. Mm-hmm. I really tried to not really read a whole lot about it. I just needed some space from it. I was really deep into it for such a long time. Kind of what I went through was pretty heavy. It was pretty much as heavy as it gets, really, at least at times. Yeah, it was, to be honest, it was, and what better place to kind of step away from bike riding, here in Missoula. There's so many other things to do. Done tons of hiking, got into paddleboarding here. We have all these fantastic, beautiful rivers here.
Mm-hmm.
Into skiing, I didn't ski for years,
It's probably your contract. You couldn't ski.
Yeah, in some of my contracts, I was not allowed to ski.
Wow.
And, but I felt like, the cycling world sort of turned their back on me,
Mm-hmm.
I get it. I cheated and lied for a long time. It was what was happening during that period in the cycling world, it was not just me. It goes really deep, far deeper than, some have come out since then and told the truth. That's 1% max, 0.5%. There's a lot that haven't come through and told the truth. Not to say they need to go out and tell the truth now, but, a lot of people turned their backs on me and thought it was just me and just Lance and just a few other bad eggs. And we were the bad guys. And everybody else was doing it fairly. But obviously that wasn't the case. And to be honest, yeah, so I kind of turned my back. I kind of just walked away from it a little bit. I kept a little bit of one pinky finger in with my coaching business, but
sure,
yeah,
yeah. I mean, I people generally we don't like nuance in our lives. We don't like things that are complicated. So to sort of write you guys off as bad eggs in an ethical system or an otherwise pristine system is it's short-sighted.
Yeah. And a lot of people then said, okay, it's doping is over.
Yeah.
Doping
that's true is done too. With. That was interesting because, you know,
obviously that's
your version. I mean, when you came out and told the truth, it seemed like you went all the way. Whereas there was this other cohort of fellas that, they seemed like they all had the very similar story. Like, hey, these are the things we did. And then we stopped on this date. And
2006, they all stopped.
Yeah. Like, yeah.
What day?
Exactly. Do they all decide on their calendars we're going to stop on this day? Probably has to deal with, you know, when they want their statute of limitations and their suspensions. It seems all negotiated.
Yeah, who knows? Who knows?
Yeah. Which,
but, you know, I can't be critical about it because I lied about all my stuff.
Yeah, there's no utility.
So, and I get it, you know. Feds came knocking on my door. You know, I had already been dealing with the doping issue for a while personally, whereas a lot of these guys, that was new to them. Right. Although they had been doping for a long time, they had not had to come to terms with the truth till then.
Right.
So I get it. I get it. You go through a period where maybe you tell 80% of the truth, but for whatever reason, you hang on to that last 20%. I don't know. But yeah. So everyone's on their own path.
Sure. You know?
And I got a little bit of a head start on them. So I ran into a guy this last year who grew up here in Butte by the name of Levi Leipheimer. So I've seen him the last two Novembers. I've done an event out in Northern California. So I bumped into him a couple times. And just in the last year, so two Novembers ago versus this last November, I saw a big change in him. Just coming to terms with it. And just being a little bit more open about it. And we made some big mistakes, but we're not bad people. He's a good person. I'm a good person, but you know, we picked the wrong time to be in the sport of professional cycling.
Or maybe the right time.
Or maybe the right. Yeah. Maybe it's all. Yeah, totally.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to kind of think about how this industry of sport, is it capable of change? You know, there's not a lot.
We've got a lot of work to do. A lot of work to do. I don't know if you've seen that movie Icarus.
Yeah. That's
insane. Yeah. And there's other one that's not, you know, I'm sure that's just the tip of the iceberg. And it's ugly, real ugly.
Yeah, I mean the whole Icarus Russia story. I mean, people are getting killed.
I mean, people are getting killed. It's getting pretty serious.
Yeah,
you know.
And so you think about that on, you know, your like NFL franchises. Those things will trade for $1 billion. I mean, these are giant corporations, businesses.
Yeah.
And I mean, it goes back to our previous question: is it possible to even have? It's an entertainment business. I mean, I guess sport in many ways is an entertainment business. Is it possible for it to be clean? Should it be clean? Like, what does that even mean?
You got to try. You got to try and try real
hard.
And we got to try harder.
Although there are some that argue, let's just, you know, eliminate all doping control and let people do what they want.
So what does that tell the young athlete then?
I agree.
So that's I get that argument, but it's a flat out, you can't do that.
Yeah. I mean, I think it sort of
you can't.
Has some logical consistency.
A little bit, but like then what do the young athletes do? They're going to follow, you know, what they're.
Yeah. From day one.
Those athletes that they look up to, they're going to do the same thing.
And the message they get is that this is the way to succeed. And
yeah.
You talk about that with skiers, the juniors and all that. Do you guys get into that at all?
You know, I work with like 8 to 14 year olds. Some of the, I guess, 13, 14 year olds, I'll talk to them about, kind of what I've been through and you know, give a little warning to them just to keep your eyes open, listen to your gut. Don't ever feel rushed to make any big decision. You know, I wish I had kind of taken a deep breath and a couple steps back before I, you know, first started, you know, that first little red testosterone pill that I took back in like 1997.
That to me, when reading your book, that's the piece that stood out to me as the most salient. And I think maybe something that's fewer people have talked about. Like, by the time you got to that moment where you took the red pill or got the paper bag or whatever, you were all in on this life, this career.
Yeah.
And in order to succeed at that level in sport or in many things in life, you have to go all in. And when you go all in, you cut off other doors.
I was all in. I dropped out of my, you know, I was in my senior year at University of Colorado. I dropped out of school. Rode for the U.S. national team for a year. Then the following year, I was professional.
Yeah.
And couple of years later into my professional career, I think I was in my third season as a professional, we were a couple months away from riding in our first Tour de France. That's, you know, that was when it was presented to me.
Yeah.
You know, and it was in a hotel room in southern Spain.
And you're either in or out.
Yeah, it was basically in or out. Yeah. And so, you know, had I known what that was going to lead to, just in terms of the doping, how much, you know, I would have been on that first flight back to Boston. You know, they slowly groomed you and, you know, started out with a couple red pills here and there, a little injection here and there of EPO that the doctor would administer. And then before I knew it, I was getting handed this little white lunch bag of the goodies to take home with me in between the races.
And it almost seemed like that system was one the athletes aspired to. Like, oh, I've arrived. I get the lunch bag. Like, I want to be in that elite group. Yep. And you're, I mean, that's the whole thing. Yep. Cycle. You're fighting to get in the elite, in the elite selection, all that. And so it's not only you don't have other options or you feel like you don't have other options, but it's also this thing I've been working for my entire life.
Yeah. I do remember before I started doping, looking around at some of my teammates getting handed these little white lunch bags after races and not really knowing what was in them and or why I didn't get one. And then I did figure it out, you know, before I ever got one. And that kind of that made me motivated to like work even harder to prove that I didn't need one. But,
oh, OK. Yeah. OK.
But eventually it was you know, back then it was 99% at least Peloton was doping. So it was like it was hard to compete against. So eventually, you know, eventually I crossed the line. The doctor came into my room and, you know, gave me a pretty heartfelt speech and told me it wasn't cheating. It was for my health. And doing that, like, it was being professional. That's what all the professionals did.
So, do you reach a point?
And then, I felt kind of like I was invited into the fraternity. I felt like at that moment, I went from the B team. Within my team, I went from the B team to the A team.
Right.
And a couple months later, I rode my first Tour de France.
That was 97.
I thought that was going to be my first and my last one. I thought so. I was like, hey, mom, dad, come over. Come over early because I don't know if I'll finish.
Right.
But I was like, you know, I saved everything back then because I thought that was, I thought I'd probably go back to school the next year and finish school and be onward.
Sure.
But little did I know, that was like just the start.
Just the very beginning.
You know, a couple of years later, I'm trying to help Lance Armstrong win the tour, you know, as his teammate. And then a couple of years after that, I'm trying to win the tour myself, which is just insane. I was just happy to be on the start line, just to have a number.
Yeah,
like one of these on your wall, you know, and I thought, honestly, that was as good as it was ever going to get. And then I was like, oh, maybe I can finish this thing in my first year. And I, sure enough, I did finish.
Yeah.
Just kept growing and growing. And the same with the dope and the doping, same thing. It was just little by little. It was like you got a little bit more into it and more into it. The pressures got higher.
Is there ever a point where it's just such a part of the fabric of your existence and the culture that it's not even thought of as cheating or lying?
You know, some of my old guys I used to race with, they have said publicly that they didn't feel like they were cheating because everybody was doing it. But I always felt I knew it was wrong. I knew it was wrong.
Well, if it's
and
secret.
I have two great parents that taught me the difference between right and wrong. I had made plenty of mistakes as a kid, but for them, it was no lying. But, you know, they allowed, I got away with some stuff, but when it came to lying, like they.
That was it.
That was it. No messing around there. Tell the truth or else.
So what's that process?
And so like I always fought with it, and I call them committee meetings. So I'd be up from 2 to 3 in the morning. I'd be there and wherever I was living at the time over in Europe, like in Spain, looking at the ceiling, just, it bothered me. And honestly, I thought this is way too big of a secret since everybody's really doing it for it not to come out. And that was my biggest fear. I would stay awake at night sometimes. So fearful that the truth would come out.
Yeah.
You know, but it was such a big secret and everybody was in on the secret, not only the riders, but the staff. These teams and a lot of the sponsors knew and all that. And I was like, how has this stayed secret for so long? And it didn't just start when I got there or when Lance got there a few years before, you know, doping and cycling had been going on for, you know, forever, really just different things over the years. But
what do you think it is about cycling that makes it such a target for that? Because it's going on in other sports. I mean, track and field is ramping.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard stories about every big sport. I've heard stories about from people from good sources.
Yeah.
For sure. And it's happening everywhere. You know, it's ski racers. It's happening in ski racing. It's happening in, you know, the four major sports here in the States. It's happening in cross-country skiing. It's happening in running. I mean, you name it, it happens. It's there. I'm not saying all the elite athletes are doing it, but there's a lot. There are some that are, and it's... What was your question?
Well, it seems like there's not a lot of incentive for these leagues, whatever it is, the NFL, the NHL, whatever.
I don't know if they want to catch.
Well, that's it. Like, you know, I was right about the time where you were starting to really get into it as a cyclist, you know, that was the late 90s when, you know, you had the Barry Bond, whatever it was, the Mark McGuire, Sammy Sosa home run race.
Yeah.
It's like 98. And
yeah.
People are printing money.
Yeah.
Watching these, these sort of monstrosities of human bodies pump out home runs. Everybody's making money.
Yeah. I was at like some sort of sports seminar speaking, I don't know, maybe 3 years ago. It was back in Boston. And they had a bunch of different big rooms where people were speaking. And the room next to me was Adam Silver, who was
the commissioner
of the NBA. And they said, this is what I heard, at least one of the journalists said, Tyler Hamilton is next door speaking about doping and cycling. Does the NBA, does the National Basketball League have a problem? He just said flat out, there's no doping in basketball.
Wow.
That's not the right attitude to have.
No, particularly as a commissioner.
No.
You gotta
make sure you're doing all the tests and all that to make sure that never happens, because you know it's possible.
Yeah.
But that kind of attitude.
Yeah, I don't know the answers either. I mean, I think about it, the world that I live in a little bit with brands and marketing.
Yeah.
Big brands are attaching themselves to athletes like you and Lance or whoever it is, and they have an easy out. Test goes positive, they can just say, oh, we're out. We had no idea.
Yeah.
It's hard to believe that these companies had no ideas this was going on.
Yeah.
So,
for sure.
Yeah, there's these entrenched power structures that have.
Yeah. But they don't have to pay the price like the athlete.
No.
You know,
not at all. I mean, you guys pay the price in terms of how much destructive force it has in your life.
Yeah.
Consequences for your body. You can be ostracized from the sport. I'm sure there was a time where you were like, well, no company's
going to touch. Think about how far Lance has fallen, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, he's picked himself up and he's moving forward again, but he had one of the largest falls from grace for any athlete, I think, in the history of the world. And he wasn't, you know, the only one doing it, the only one in his circle mm-hmm. that knew about it. You know, there were plenty of people that aided that. You know, he hasn't gone on to talk about it yet. Hopefully someday he will, but I think that would help.
Yeah.
Him and the sport. But, there was a big circle of people around it supporting it. And now, as soon as it all goes bad, you know, everyone turns their back. Oh, I knew nothing. Not to defend his actions, but the system was large.
Yeah, it makes you wonder, like, how change actually happens. I guess it happens.
Now it's all about enjoying sport, enjoying being active.
So let's talk about that for a second. So you, I mean, kind of, actually, I've known you around town a little bit. We got mutual friends. But then I stumbled into this podcast a few weeks ago you did with Ryan Corey.
Yeah, great guy.
Bikepacking. And then I remember following your Instagram that you had done this trip from Banff down through Whitefish on the Continental Divide Trail.
It was so cool.
Yeah.
So cool.
So it seems like there's this type of cycling now that has maybe rekindled a bit of passion for you.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it's called bikepacking. It's like backpacking but on a bike. You know, they have all these really cool bags.
Yeah, I tell people about it, and they're like, how's that?
I know, most people are like, what? It's basically bike touring, whatever you want to call it.
But with better gear.
Way better gear. You're not having those, like, the bags are pretty sleek, so you're not pushing a lot of extra wind, so to speak.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's great. I'm a total rookie at it, but I got some, you know, I was fortunate enough to get a bike from one of my, I have a couple sponsors, and I was able to get a bike.
That's an open cycle?
It's a Canadian bike.
And is it Gerard Vermin? Because they did Cervelo when you guys were on CSC.
It's a guy who used to do Cervelo. Yep. It's called a gravel grinder. So it's in between like a cyclocross bike, you know, and a mountain bike.
Okay.
So it basically can go wherever a mountain bike can go, minus the super rocky, big drop off kind of trails.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it doesn't have suspension, but I rode it on I've ridden it. So, you know, in the last year on a lot of technical trails. So you can ride anywhere on the road, you know, on the gravel on the side of the road if the road doesn't have much of a shoulder. You know, these days with people on cell phones driving.
Yeah, and in Montana sometimes, too.
Yeah, we don't have great bike lanes here, just in general in Montana. So sometimes when you are on the road, I ride, you know, 5 feet over in the dirt on this thing because it can handle it. You're not going to get it flat.
And so getting out there by yourself in the wilderness, I mean, it's got to go back to some of your childhood in the White Mountains.
Yeah,
And some of the pure aspects of sport.
I just love being in nature. I love animals, like love them. And being able to experience, I love being, I like doing a lot of it by myself. It's fun. I'm kind of an introvert.
Yeah.
And I did this great route from Banff, Canada down just a little bit outside of Whitefish.
Okay. Yeah.
And all on this trail called the Great Divide Mountain Bike Route. And it was awesome. Saw a lot of wildlife. Saw a grizzly bear on the first day.
Wow.
Which was great. Went through a section called the Grizzly Bear Corridor, which is in the Flathead Valley, on the Canadian section of the Flathead Valley. Basically north of Pole Bridge up in there. It's dense. It's remote. And they call it the Grizzly Bear Corridor. That was probably the highlight. I was definitely really nervous in that section. You know, I had bear spray and I must have yelled, "Hey, bear," 1,000 times that day.
Oh, yeah. I know that much.
You know what I mean? Just yell it. Keep yelling it. And
make noise.
Yeah. Lots of noise. But there were a few times where I was, yeah.
And so as you've gotten into this kind of new style of cycling to you, are you now with your coaching business at all taking it in that direction?
We're going to start heading that way a little bit, but I mean, I'm still learning myself, so I'm not coaching the athletes. You know, there's people that race these super long distances.
Absolutely.
Now, and that's becoming more and more popular. Mm-hmm. But I would say I still have some learning to do before I want to coach somebody. I'm going to take a little time on that. But yeah, that's something where we're heading that way. Whatever people need in terms of coaching on the bike, you know.
However they want to get better.
Yeah. For sure.
That's one question I have.
So we coach mostly weekend warrior types, people that have families, you know, 40 to 50 hour a week job, limited amount of time to ride their bike, but they love riding and they might be getting ready for a charity event or one of these grand fondos, as they call them. Or some people like to race a little bit.
But yes, most of our people are
weekend warriors.
Like, how do you kind of differentiate your coaching? Like, what is your...
Yeah, it's all custom based. There's no two programs that are the same. So get to know the individual, their goals, you know, what they're looking for, and start from there. It's a little bit of a process to get going.
But once
you get going, it's you see their improvements pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. And for me, that's the best part, is to hear them smiling.
Yeah, and then you can ride with these people too.
But sometimes I get to ride with them, but a lot of it's from afar. So hear them just happy on the phone. Or sometimes you talk to their significant other on the phone there, and they're like, "Oh my God, they're so happy now! Thank you! Like, it's helped our relationship because of it." And like, that's music to my ears.
Yeah.
I love hearing that. You know, our hard work is helping.
Well, it sounds like you've kind of figured out ways to work in service of others, but also in a way that you find joy in cycling and in the more pure aspects of sport.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't really like to compete anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, competition, in a way, sometimes takes away the pure joy of it, you know. Mm-hmm. I love just riding my bike. I didn't realize that for a while. I kind of turned my back to riding, and it's awesome, or get out hiking or whatever. Sometimes, not to say competition is bad, competition is great, as I look up on your wall with all these race numbers.
Well, but I
you know, mean, but like sometimes, you know, I've competed my whole life, and I competed at the highest of high levels, you know. For me now, it's just about enjoying being outdoors. And it's good for you too, right?
Absolutely.
Not only for your head, but just, for your mind, for your body, for your soul, everything. It's great to turn your back on. It was
not an option.
I'm glad I kind of saw the light, so to speak.
Yeah. I mean, I think the overall arching theme of this conversation is that life is messy. Everything's messy.
Life is messy. Yeah.
You know, this thing, sport, and the industry surrounding it is, there's so much good in it.
There's a lot of good, but I think with everything in life, there's...
It's not universally good.
Yep. Yeah. Keep your eyes open. Listen to your gut. You know?
Yeah.
I wish I had done that more in my life.
Right.
Don't rush into any major decision based on someone else's, the pressure that somebody else might give you. But yeah, try to enjoy life. And I don't know, now I try to take life a little less seriously. And I mean, I'm serious about the things that I do, but I try to kind of let my hair down a little bit and just enjoy everything. Mm-hmm. Life's pretty amazing. It can get complicated sometimes, but
it's the only shot we got. So
at
least as far as we know.
Yeah.
So Tyler, I can't thank you enough for being so generous with your time.
Oh yeah.
Anytime. And just your openness and your willingness to just jump in. We don't know each other well.
Yeah.
I hope we get to know each other better.
Absolutely.
As I said before, like, I've been inspired and respectful of how you've shared your story. And you, I've often heard you say, like, hey, open book, ask any question.
Yeah.
So as we close here, I guess my question for you is there a question that nobody's asking that you're kind of surprised by? You know, a lot of people ask you the same questions. I know we talked about some of the, you know, a lot of the doping stuff.
But yeah.
What's the question that people aren't asking?
I don't know. That's a good question. I don't know. I think, what are people not asking me?
It's a stumper.
You have stumped me. No, I don't know. I don't really think about that a lot. Just
Well, then how about what's next? What's next for you? What's the next thing you're, the next change for you?
The next change?
Yeah.
The next change. I don't know, just continuing doing what I'm doing. Some things are evolving. You know, I got my partner up with a buddy, my old best friend back in Boston. He wants to build some cool homes out here, sort of like base camp home type
thing. Oh, interesting.
Built for the adventure.
Sure. You know? Place to sleep.
But built for the sort of the younger crowd, not very expensive. So yeah, we'll see. We'll see. We're now just talking about it, but he's certainly very motivated. And feel like I'm getting to know this area pretty well, so we'll see. I'll keep you posted on all that. But yeah, continuing to help the MS community, continue doing these talks. I've got a couple international trips scheduled this year, I guess, 2018. Wow, 2018.
Yeah, we're
already here. One's in Ireland and one's in Argentina, so I'm going to try to plan a bike pack trip around those.
Nice.
Yeah. Send you some pictures.
Please do.
Coaching business, continuing working hard on that. It's been slowly growing over the years. And, it's been a lot of fun. Who knows what else is out there, but I'm definitely open. Yeah, I'm definitely at an interesting part of my life right now, kind of starting over in many different ways. Yeah, I'm enjoying it. I'm enjoying just the ride, I guess.
Awesome. Well, yeah. that's a great way to close it, enjoying the ride.
Yeah.
Again, can't thank you enough for your time.
Awesome.
For your contributions to this community. So
thanks for having me on your show.
That's fun. Thank you.
We're good?
Yeah, we're good.
Awesome. You're a good interviewer.
Oh, I don't know. I mean,
what do you mean you don't know? Take it. You're not good with compliments. Take the compliment.
All right. Thanks for listening to A New Angle. We really appreciate it. If you enjoy this podcast, there are several ways you can support it. First, rate us on iTunes. Ratings help others find the podcast. Second, write a review. The more reviews we get, and hopefully positive ones, the more we can grow the show. And third, just tell your friends about it. In addition, you can also support A New Angle financially. For information on sponsorship opportunities, please visit our website, www.business.umt.edu/anewangle. There you will also find a link to donate to the pod. Before we go, I'd like to thank a few folks for making this project happen. First, my colleagues here at the College of Business for supporting this endeavor. In particular, I'd like to thank Professor Josh Herbold for writing and recording music for the show. We also have music provided by Switchback Records, a student-run record label here at the college. And thanks to my producer, Stefan Borsum. Finally, if you have any questions, suggestions, comments, insults, whatever, please email me at anewangle@umontana.edu. Help us spread the word. And be sure to use the hashtag #anewangle on all your various social channels. Thanks a lot, and see you next time.